want to invite you, if you're able this morning, to stand with me. Matthew chapter 27, we're going to begin in verse 32. And the reason there's so much in this passage is because this passage, along with those for the next couple weeks, are the crux of all hope for humanity. You say, Pastor, that's too big of a statement. That's probably an understatement. That Jesus died on the cross, that he was buried, and that he was raised, is the only reason there is meaning in life. And those who think that this did not happen have to face the reality that their life truly has no eternal meaning. And you can't get around that. And so maybe that's worth at least 8 quick points this morning. Matthew chapter 27, beginning in verse 32. As they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head, they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priest with the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. You may be seated. Jesus has been abused. He has been mocked. He has been severely beaten. And we read that on the way to the place called Golgotha, that someone is compelled to carry his cross. No doubt this is because of the poor shape that Jesus' body was in by this point. There's no reason to believe that this was a compassionate move, but a move of necessity. And a man named Simon is compelled to carry his cross, and he carries it to the place called Golgotha, and there they crucified Jesus. They crucify him, and it's not enough that they simply have condemned him to death and then used this instrument of torture, the cross, to put him to death. But in everything that they do throughout these verses, from verse 32 to verse 44, is to make a mockery of Jesus. As I mentioned before, there's 8 of these that we'll consider as we move through this passage, but there are others that are there and present. It wasn't enough simply to kill Jesus, but this is an attempt to destroy him and everything that he stood for and all that he taught. See, crucifixion was a warning. It's why it was done publicly. It's why it was done in a place where people could pass by and see. It was a warning It's what Rome used it for. To tell people, this same fate awaits you if you do these same things that have been charged to the one who's dying. It's why Pilate has this charge put above him that this is Jesus, the King of the Jews. If you look at the other Gospels, there are other things that the sign says because it was written in more than one language. So it can be translated some different ways, the King of Israel, King of the Jews. We read elsewhere that the religious leaders didn't like that. They wanted it to say that he said he was the King of the Jews, but Pilate leaves it as it is. It's ironic because it's true, but that's not why they put it there. It was to serve as a warning for others that might follow Jesus. All of this was to make a mockery of him. And we should remember that as we think about the cross, that it wasn't only that Jesus died, but how he died, the brutality with which he died, but more than that, because the gospel isn't talking about that. In fact, it's written very simply, and when they had crucified him, we often think about the brutality of the cross. The Bible doesn't describe that in detail. We know those things from history. We can surmise about how bad the things were because of what we know about crucifixion and how it was brutal and how it killed someone so very slowly and how you literally would suffocate as your lungs filled with fluid because of the work that your body put in, pushing itself up time and time and time again to draw a breath. The pain that Jesus must have felt as his back has been torn apart and now it is forced up against this tree and he has to rise and fall to catch his next breath. While the scripture doesn't talk to us and tell us those details, there is great detail given to us on the mockery that Jesus faces. It's the subject of this passage, the mockery that Jesus endures. So I want us to see these eight actions that were used to mock Jesus. Again, if you have the notes, just I welcome you to follow along with me. I think we could see that there's mockery in the fact that Jesus is so broken that he can't carry his own cross, that someone else is brought in. You can see that and understand the embarrassment of that as Jesus has been tortured to the point of weakness. But when he gets to this place called Golgotha, which means the place of a skull, the thought is there that it probably looked like a skull. Scholars and historians aren't exactly sure the exact place Jesus was crucified. There's multiple options there outside of the city because that's where it would be carried out. It was a visual representation of Jesus being removed from his people. He's taken outside of the city and he's crucified there. But the mockery begins in earnest in verse 34, where he has offered him wine to drink mixed with gall, and when he tasted it, he would not drink it. It was bitter. It appears that it's a moment of compassion from these soldiers that have been charged with executing Jesus. It looks like it would be a cup that if you'd been through everything that Jesus had been through, you would welcome as some small relief. And yet he tastes it and he doesn't drink. There's some throughout church history that have thought that Jesus did not drink that cup because he didn't want anything to dull his senses so that he would be fully aware of the wrath of God that was coming, that there wouldn't be anything to minimize that. And it may be so. But we have to understand, again, looking at the pattern of those who have been in charge of torturing Jesus, that there's no reason to expect compassion from them. Again, had Jesus not been fully broken, they would not have compelled someone to carry his cross. It was the responsibility of the one who was condemned, that shame, to bear their cross all the way to the point of their own crucifixion. And so here Jesus is mocked. In this moment of weakness, this moment of torment, here's the cup that could offer some relief to his thirst. He's at this point lost tremendous amounts of blood. He would have been severely dehydrated. And yet even the cup they offer him is a mockery. It's more torment. It's more torture. They have mixed in this gall with this wine, and it makes it bitter. But friends, we should remember that even though Jesus faces this mockery and his thirst was great, he goes on to the cross. See, we have to keep in our mind at any point, as he told his disciples in the garden, I could call these 12 legions of angels and they would come rescue me. See, our backdrop can't be, well, there's nothing Jesus can do about it. At each and every point, he is committed to doing what God has called him to do, and to do so on your behalf. Not arbitrarily. It's not something that we think about for everyone else. It's not abstract. We don't need to think about this in the context of Jesus doing this for the world, though he is. When you read this, understand that in this mockery, when he is thirsty and they are offering him something to drink that's not fit to drink, instead of calling those angels and delivering himself for you, he bears that mockery. For you, he endures that pain and hardship. And he does so that he will be your living water. Because remember what he told the woman at the well. If you knew who you were talking to, you would ask, and I would give you living water, and you would never thirst again. This is the moment where he is winning for you the opportunity to give you living water. He is paying your debt as he goes to the cross. He is dying in your place so that for you, he can be living water. He bears this thirst so that you never have to thirst again. Don't miss what he endured on your behalf. Next, he endures the mockery of them taking his clothes. Verse 35, he doesn't drink this drink, and so they crucified him. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sit down to keep watch over him. When we have a passion play, we put Jesus on the cross. Not sure is the best thing to do, but it's done and you've seen it. Because of our own modesty, we often have Jesus with some type of clothing on. It would be inappropriate not to. But Roman crucifixion was mostly done to someone who had all their clothes taken. They were completely naked before the entire world. It seems to be the case here, because when Jesus is crucified, they take his clothing and they divide it up. They cast lots. And those who were there, they had a legal right through the Roman system of justice to take the clothes of the one who was being crucified. And so here's Jesus. He has been beaten, mocked, bruised, They put the crown of thorns on his head. They mocked him as a king. They put a robe on him. They took it again, stripped it from him. And here in his last moments, he's exposed to this great shame. It's interesting, if you go back into Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve sin, they realize that they are naked. And God, in His graciousness toward them, He takes an animal and He kills it. And He takes the animal skin and provides them clothing. Because in their sin and in their shame, they are exposed to the world. And they realize that. And here in Jesus' last moments, He's stripped of His clothing in an attempt to strip His dignity. And He hangs in front of the world, hanging on the cross, exposed. And in that moment, he could call those angels. It wouldn't have taken 12 legions of angels. He could have called one to deliver him from this shame, this indignity. But for you, He's willing to endure this shame. He's willing to be exposed to the world, to suffer this embarrassment, to bring you redemption. They take His clothing. The last thing that He had, remember, Jesus was a simple man. He had no place to lay His head, He tells us. But they try to strip Him of His dignity. And instead of calling those angels to deliver Him, He is willing to be exposed for your redemption, so that you would be saved. So that your shame, as Adam and Eve's shame was covered in the garden by the grace of God, that your shame would be covered by the grace of Christ on the cross. They mock Him by taking His clothing. They mock Him with the charge against Him, we read in verse 37. Over His head they put the charge against Him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." This charge is truthful. It's not a lie. Though it's mocking, it's not a lie. But they did not believe this. They did not believe that He was the King of the Jews. See, He is nothing to them. He is a common criminal, a nuisance to be cast away. Later on, when Peter is preaching in the book of Acts in chapter 3, he's sharing the gospel with some of those very people, it seems, that had put Jesus to death. And he tells them that what they did was done in ignorance, and that God had overlooked that ignorance in times past. They put up a mocking charge above Him, but they do not acknowledge Him as King. And yet He endures this mockery. In fact, He allows this mockery to be overlooked for a time. To these very people who mock Him, He looks down upon them. Though He has the title above His head that they are using to make fun of Him, He looks down over them in His capacity as the King of the Jews and says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing." Think about how many people today continue to mock Jesus by the titles that they give him or call him. And yet he endures it. But there is coming a time when, though he might be called King of the Jews and mockery, Revelation 17:14 reminds us that he is the King of kings and Lord of lords for all eternity. He could demonstrate to them right then that he is the King of the Jews. He could call those legions of angels to come and deliver him. But instead, with you in mind, he continues to hang on the cross. Fourth, they mock him by hanging him beside criminals. He's done no wrong. We've seen that. We've journeyed with Jesus through this gospel. We've seen nothing but good. It's interesting because in this passage, they would acknowledge that Jesus has done good. In verse 42, the religious leaders, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, in their mockery of Jesus, they say he saved others. He cannot save himself. They acknowledge that he has saved other people. But here we're told in verse 38, two robbers are crucified with him, one on the right, one on the left. The term robbers here is interesting. From the context of the other Gospels, it's very likely that these men are criminals, as we often think about them. But the word itself is can also be, and often is, attributed to people that are revolutionaries, people that are rebels. And again, the context of the other Gospel makes us think that they're probably more genuinely criminals, but I find it interesting that the charge of Jesus in the verse before about him being the King of the Jews is a statement of rebellion against Rome. And yet here are two men, and Matthew calls them rebels or revolutionaries. Whatever it is, whether they were just plain criminals or they had some nationalistic ideas in their actions, they are true violators of the law of Rome. They deserve to be there. In fact, in Luke's gospel in 23 and verse 41, one of the robbers, the one who later on is saved, says, "We are receiving the due reward for our deeds." He admits, "We deserve to be here." But Jesus didn't. Jesus did not deserve to die on the cross. He had done no wrong. He is the Lamb without spot or blemish. What a mockery it is to take someone who is innocent and put them with the one who is guilty. We think about our own system of government and justice. If you truly believe in our system of justice, then the worst thing that can happen is that someone who is innocent is condemned. And we know that that has happened in history. And it's one of the great stains on our justice system. Some people think that the great stain is that the one who is guilty is found not guilty. But that's not the case. It's the burden of the government to prove their case in court that you or I committed a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they fail to do that, it is unfortunate. God will account for that one day. God does know all, whether we are found guilty or not. But we understand the great tragedy is when someone is innocent, when they are not guilty. And yet, for whatever reason, they're found guilty. Their freedom is taken away. They're placed in prison with those who are guilty, with those who have been found guilty and are guilty of crimes. They're placed there unjustly. We think about the cases we have heard where men and women have been freed after 20 or 30 years, and it was determined they had not committed that crime. And yet here's the greatest injustice. Jesus, not only not guilty of the crimes for which he was accused, but sinless. The perfect keeper of the law. And yet here he hangs, with robbers on his right and on his left. And though he had done nothing wrong, he was willing to be numbered with the transgressors, as Isaiah says in Isaiah 53:12, to bear your sin. If I ask you today to go into prison, there's a man there. He was not guilty, but he was convicted. And he has 5 years left on his sentence. The only way he can get out is if you will go and stay there for those 5 years. He's innocent. He did not do it. Who'd be the first to volunteer to give up 5 years of their life for the remainder of his sentence? I don't think a lot of you are going to jump at that. I'm probably not. I'm not. See, that's not what Jesus did. Because what if I ask you to go serve the remainder of the sentence for the guilty man? He is certainly guilty of that crime. And he doesn't have 5 years left, he has a lifetime left. And he did it. He's caught red-handed. No doubt about it. Took the jury minutes to come back with their verdict. But I want you to go take his place. Don't think anybody's rushing the stage to grab up that opportunity. And yet that's what Jesus did. Because you and I are guilty. We are guilty in every possible way of our sin. We have committed sin. We have disobeyed the law of God. And yet here hangs Jesus on the cross in our place, willing to be numbered with the transgressors, which was prophesied by Isaiah in Isaiah 53 and verse 12. Jesus did that for you. He went and died in your place. It's a mockery to hang him with criminals. And yet Jesus willingly hangs there for you, numbered with the transgressors, to bear your sin. He takes on your sentence. He takes on your punishment. And he does so willingly. Number five, they make false accusations. They lie. Look at verse 40. And saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." Jesus didn't say that. Jesus never said that he would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. It's not what he said. It's just a lie. And it doesn't matter how much it's repeated, it's still a lie. It was a lie when it was first said there at his trial, when they couldn't get the witnesses to agree. They couldn't find two people to condemn him. It's still a lie here, though they have used it for condemnation and he's hanging on the cross. It is still a lie. He never said it. They twisted his words. Those that are passing by, the religious leaders who we encounter in the next few verses, even the guys hanging on the cross, we're told by the end, they revile him in the same way. They all lied about Jesus. Friends, that continues today. People continue to lie about Jesus. They lie about who he was, who he is. They lie about his character. They lie about his nature. Some lie by saying he was just a prophet or some good teacher. People lie by saying he did not talk exclusively about himself and him being the only way to God. Some lie by saying he would be tolerant of the sins that for some reason happen to be the same sins that we have become tolerant of in our culture. It's all a lie. And the lies are great. And he could have stopped all of those lies in that moment. Father, I'm finished with them. In next week's message, he'll say, it's finished. He'll give up his spirit. But he could have said here, Father, I'm done with them. Send the angels. I'm not tolerating this anymore. They're not going to continue to lie about me. But he does not do so. Though the lies are great, he's willing to be lied about to be the way, the truth, and the life. Because only through the cross is he the way, the truth, and the life. Why? Because he said he was going to go to the cross. And had he come down off the cross, then instead of them lying about him, he would have been made a liar. But in Jesus, there is no lie. Because he is the way, the truth, and the life. Number six, they quote the devil. When we look at verse 40, if you are the Son of God, in that last sentence. If you read that verse, it should recall to mind something we've heard before. Now, I will say that you've slept a few times since then because it takes us all the way back a couple of years. But in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 3 and chapter 4 and verse 6, we hear this same phrase, if you are the Son of God. This time we hear it from the passers-by. But that time in Matthew chapter 4, we heard it from Satan himself. See, when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan used that expression to try to tempt Jesus. Well, if you're the Son of God, you should be able to do this. If you're the Son of God, you should be able to do that. And it's interesting here, because the Bible tells us who some of the people are that are mocking him, the other thieves on the cross, the chief priests and the scribes and elders with him. But this first group, those who pass by, it's vague. And they are speaking as they pass by, unknowingly, I'm sure. But they're speaking words directly from the devil, from Satan himself. It's a final temptation. Satan is tempting Jesus one more time. He tried at the beginning of his ministry and he failed. And here, these words are a temptation again. If you're really the Son of God, come down from the cross. What an amazing connection this is that Matthew gives us, bringing us from the beginning of his gospel now to the end. One last jab that Satan takes, trying to get Jesus off course. At the beginning, he tempts him with bread. If you're hungry, you can eat. Here's something to eat. Jesus had been fasting 40 days in Matthew chapter 4. He offers him power and honor. All of this could be yours. But Jesus does not waver. And here, Jesus is tempted again. Though the tempter comes once again, Jesus obeys the commands of the Father. The Father had sent him, what? To go to the cross. And from the beginning of his ministry until this point, he has obeyed the Father, and he is not stopping now. And friends, he does so for you. He doesn't have to prove himself in this moment. If you're the Son of God, come off the cross. He proves himself clearly in the next chapter when he's raised from the dead. But understand what a temptation this was. He could be delivered in this moment. He could prove to all of them who he was. But we understand it would not have been sufficient. So they tempt him by quoting the devil. Number seven, they mock him. They mock him by blaming him for their disbelief. Look at verse 41 and 42. So the chief priest with the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him." What more could Jesus have done for them to believe? You ever thought about this? Like, what more could Jesus have done for people to have believed in him? We understand this differently. I think John's gospel gets at that when Thomas wants to see a sign, he wants to verify Jesus, and Jesus talks about those who are blessed when they believe though they've not seen. We live in that reality, that tension. We have faith, right? We have not witnessed these things about Jesus, but we have faith that they have occurred. But not so much for them. These elders and the chief priests and the scribes, they don't have to have faith. At least not faith that's without any type of sight. They have witnessed these things. They acknowledge them. He saved others, they say here. They acknowledge that they have seen what Jesus has been able to do. Have they seen it all? No. But have they seen enough? Certainly. And yet they say, "If you'll do this one more thing, Jesus, we could believe in you if you would come down off the cross." Do you not think if Jesus in that moment had come down off the cross, if he simply by the word of his mouth or the thoughts of his mind had removed the nails from his hand, stepped down off of the cross? Do you not think that those religious leaders would have tried to find some way to kill him? Do you not think that these chief priests and the scribes would have been the first ones to try to grab the spear from the Roman soldier's hand to thrust it into Jesus' side? Their hearts are hardened. They have no desire to believe. And so here they mock Jesus by blaming him. Each person is always responsible for their own sin and disbelief. You cannot blame anyone, especially God, for your lack of belief. You are responsible. I am responsible. I'm always amazed at the number of people who will say, "Well, I don't follow Jesus or I don't go to church because when I was young, this or that happened." Friends, that does not add up to anything on that day when we stand before God. If church A hurts you, go to church B. Jesus didn't hurt you. Your interaction with sinful people may have hurt you. But Jesus didn't hurt you. He's never done anything but care for you. He's never done anything but give his life for you. We cannot blame Jesus for our disbelief. And yet that's exactly what they do. And it was their disbelief that condemned Jesus. And yet we read in John 17 where Jesus prayed that the world would believe. How powerful is that? That in his high priestly prayer before he went to the cross, he prayed that the world would believe, even as the world's disbelief sent him to the cross. They mock him as they blame him for disbelief. And then eighth, they mock him because they call his father a liar. Look in verse 43. He trusts in God. This is as they're mocking Jesus. He's hanging on the cross and the religious leaders are mocking him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. What's the implication in that statement? If God doesn't deliver you right now from the cross, God doesn't really desire you. In other words, he doesn't love you. You say that you and the Father are one. You say that you are the Son of God. And yet, if God lets you die on this cross right now, God doesn't really care about you. Remember, the Old Testament tells us that cursed is the one who hangs on the tree. And so for them, unless you come off the cross right now, unless God delivers you from the cross, he doesn't really care for you. But this flies in the face of what we know about the Father's relationship with Jesus. See, the world hated him. But we've seen throughout this gospel that Jesus is the Son in whom the Father is well pleased. We saw that in Matthew 3:17 at Jesus' baptism. We saw that when Jesus stood with Moses and Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration. Remember, the Father speaks. He doesn't point to Moses. He doesn't point to the authority in Elijah. But he looks at Jesus. He says, "This is my Son." The religious leaders may not have been there for those two times. But as the readers of Matthew's gospel, we were. And we know exactly how the Father feels about Jesus. And the religious leaders here, by saying this, if God really desired you, he would save you. And what they're doing is they're calling the Father a liar. The Father has said of Jesus, "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased." But the religious leaders say God is a liar. Wouldn't that be enough? Wouldn't that be enough to end it all? To stop this madness? To step down off the cross? To condemn all of those who are there and mocking? Has Jesus not endured enough? Has he not endured enough heartache and sorrow and abuse? And yet he does not come down off the cross. He does utter, as we'll see in next week's message, those famous lines, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus is at the lowest point of his life. And the burden of not only his death on the cross, but the burden of the weight he is carrying of our sin has brought him to this dark point. So dark that the skies turn to darkness. But you know what he doesn't do? He does not stop caring about you. He does not give up in that moment and deliver himself at the expense of your life. That's what's at play as this passage ends. Whose life will Jesus value most? Will it be his own and delivering himself from torture and mockery? Or will he value your life and give himself as a ransom for many? Friends, as we think about Jesus' life, this sacrifice that's made, this mockery he endures, this torment that he faces, it was for us. It is costly. The question is, what do we then do? This is what Jesus has done, not just for the world, not just for his church, but this is what he endured on your behalf. How then should that cause us to live differently? How should we value each day we have in our life? How should we understand our calling to go into the world and make disciples? Those words are coming. We've been waiting on them to come. That is the reaction that the disciples are called to have to the mockery that Jesus endures. Because many people you know and love have never experienced what it means to be given life from the one who endured such mockery. Friends, what are you doing with this great gift that he's given? That when the moment came where he could deliver himself and leave you in your sin, leave you with no hope, he chose to breathe his last, to give up his spirit, and to pay the price for you. What are you doing with the great gift that he's given you of life? Will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we thank you for your grace and your mercy. We thank you that you love us and care for us, and you have given us hope beyond all measure. My prayer is that as we see this difficulty, this mockery that you have endured, that it would spur us on to live our lives dedicated to you, following you faithfully, telling others about your goodness, bringing others into the kingdom, living a life worthy of our calling. Heavenly Father, lead and guide us. We thank you for the sacrifice that was made. Our prayer is that we would live worthy of our calling, and that we would do so in the power of your Spirit and through your grace, as we pray in Christ's name. Amen. I want to invite you to stand. We're going to sing a song. Friends, your response is this: if you do not know Jesus this morning, this is what he's done for you because he loves you. Would you come and let me share with you how you can follow him? If you do know him, this was the cost of your life. You are called, I am called, to give our lives as a living sacrifice. In other words, each day in all that we do, we give ourselves to Christ through the way that we live. So the question for you is, how do you do that today? What do you need to do today for your life to be a living sacrifice to Jesus? For you to say, I'm not worried about what I want and my preferences. That's not what Jesus did. He could have called 12 legions of angels, thousands and thousands of angels to deliver him, but he doesn't. He gave himself, so now we give ourselves to him. What do you need to do today? What do you need to do tomorrow? What do you need to do this week for your life to be a sacrifice to Christ? If you pray, I promise God will show you what you must do, what you need to do, what He's calling you to do, to live a life dedicated to Him. Would you respond to His word this morning?